Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Saturday, April 20th, day 197 of the war with Hamas. Amanda Borshel Dan here with our U.S. Bureau Chief, Jacob Magid. Hi, Shabbat Shalom, Jacob.
Shabbat Shalom, Amanda.
We will learn more details about the alleged Israeli strike on Iran yesterday and the responses out of the United States. We'll hear about a vetoed vote for Palestinian statehood at the United Nations and how the U.S. is increasing its sanctions on accused extremist Jews. We'll also get an update on the push for normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. All this and more when we're back.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Turkey's President Erdogan and Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh have begun talks in Istanbul as tensions in the Middle East soar. Hamas's political chiefs are reportedly exploring moving their base of operations out of Qatar. Two Western officials told the New York Times that a missile fired in an alleged Israeli strike on air defenses of the Natanz nuclear site in Iran had technology that enabled the weapon to evade the country's radar defense systems. The New York Times reported that a warplane from which the missile was launched was, quote, far from Israeli or Iranian airspace, and neither the jet nor the missile entered Jordanian airspace. The alleged Israeli strike in Iran overnight between Thursday and Friday went far beyond the scope of several small drones described by Tehran, and the strike reportedly included at least one missile launched by Israeli Air Force warplanes that targeted an air defense radar near Isfahan. Jacob, what are we hearing from the U.S. so far about the attack on Iranian soil, which was, of course, something that the White House apparently specifically asked Israel not to do?
Yeah, so the response has been mum's the word. We have not heard very much from U.S. officials, and I think there was a directive that went through to the different offices saying just don't comment right now. I think there's this effort by the U.S. to, in hoping that by just not saying anything, that this tit for tat will be over. The only thing that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Friday was that the U.S. wasn't involved in the strike and that it's seeking de-escalation. I think Israel seems to be cooperating with this strategy. For the most part, we haven't heard Israeli officials say too much, definitely not on the record, except for, I think we had Itamar Ben-Gvir, the National Security Minister, call the attack lame. I think the silence that we've seen, I think, lends to this feeling that maybe the far right in Israel and others have that this wasn't a significant strike, even as we hear gradual reporting regarding what happened that indicates that there were some major blows dealt to the Iranian military capabilities in Isfahan. So we'll have to see. U.S. White House Middle East Czar Brett McGurk on Friday held this briefing with American Jewish community leaders, and he again also didn't want to talk about the strike in specifics. And he said, I think when historians look at the past 2 weeks, it's about managing a crisis in a way that I think very much restored deterrence. I think Israel has come out of this actually significantly stronger. So that's the U.S. approach. I think they're trying to package this as a win for Israel and hoping that it'll convince Israel not to take further strikes against Iran, and hoping that by not talking about it, not blowing this out of proportion that Iran will make a decision not to hit back against Israel. So we'll have to see what happens.
There's reporting, of course, that Israel did such a, shall we say, insignificant strike, allegedly, because it wanted to send a message of what Iran could expect were Israel to really go guns out. And as I said initially, there was reporting that it was three drones. Drones, of course, can be the size of a car and heavily armored and heavily weaponized. But in the end, we're hearing about new technology. All of this is, of course, very unclear. There has been some satellite imaging, however, that did show damage. Jacob, do you know how to explain this imaging that has been shown to some members of the press?
Yeah, it looks like our military correspondent, Manny Fabian, was one of the people who was able to see some of the damage. It was done on the condition that it not be published. So the public is a little bit in the dark on what happened, but there is an understanding that there was some damage done to the military sites themselves, not necessarily to the nuclear facilities. So that's a pretty strong difference. And I think Israel was probably significantly urged by the U.S. and Arab allies not to target the nuclear facilities. If you're going to go into Iran, I think there was hopes that they would just strike the proxies out of Iran. But the fact that they did it not by targeting the nuclear facilities, I think, was very much a choice Israel made not to escalate the situation further. But also, as you mentioned, the fact that just how the strike in and of itself demonstrates Israel's technology and capabilities, the fact that there was U.S. Senator Marco Rubio tweeted as the strike was going on that, you should know that Israeli jets have the capability of hitting targets in Iran without entering Iranian airspace, which is quite incredible if you think about it, that they're probably making these strikes from Iraq or Syria. And actually, there were debris that fell inside of Iraq that are believed to have belonged to Israeli munitions. So it is a testament to just the way that Israel can get around Iranian radar systems and still manage to damage them at the same time.
The thwarting of the Iranian strike on Israel earlier in the week, it's only been a week, which is incredible to think about, was really definitely a testament to Israeli firepower. 99% of the missiles, the projectiles, didn't make it to Israeli soil, but it was also such evidence of what this team of regional players alongside the US, Britain, France, what they can do playing together to ward off this Iranian threat. And that's something that McGurk talked about yesterday as well, no?
So yeah, I think McGurk made a point that this demonstrated the capabilities of the regional partners, not just the UK and France, but also Jordan that was involved in intercepting some of the missiles. And there have been reports about Saudi and Emirati intelligence that was shared, along with Bahrain. So all these partners that are working together, and the US has been working to formalize this kind of regional security architecture that will create some sort of umbrella across the Middle East, protecting the U.S. allies and U.S. interests, and obviously the interests of those countries that are participating. And McGurk said that we're trying to formalize this this effort through, well, he didn't say it specifically, but clearly he's referring to the Saudi normalization deal, which would allow for even more cooperation and even more intelligence sharing between these countries in order to thwart future Iranian attacks.
Okay, so let's dive into that idea of Saudi normalization, since you brought it up. And it's somewhat counterintuitive to me that right now, despite everything that's going on in Gaza, has been going on in Gaza, and the region is, of course, thinking that Israel is just the worst thing ever. And the Biden administration has been kind of scolding Bibi for the conduct of the war. But at the same time, the administration has managed to continue these high-level discussions with Saudi Arabia to broker a normalization agreement between the Gulf Kingdom and the Jewish state. You're being told this by three U.S. officials, and there are some who have said that Hamas even sparked the war to ward off this normalization. So the question is, what is the U.S. signaling by telling you this information right now, that putting it out there into the media right now?
Not just some. It was U.S. President Joe Biden said that one of the goals of Hamas was to try to thwart this normalization effort. I think they're trying to keep this on the agenda right now in hopes that, I think, to try to get some sort of breakthrough on this deal, that there's been progress over the past few weeks. We've bridged some of the gaps on the Saudi-U.S. bilateral issues regarding the defense guarantees that the Saudi is seeking from the U.S. and a support for a civilian nuclear program that it's also looking to establish. There are still definitely gaps that need to be closed, but they said, the officials I spoke with said, that they're definitely bridgeable. But the bigger wild card is the Saudi normalization component of this mega deal, that you also need to have a Palestinian component of this normalization agreement in order to get the Saudis on board, and that it'll likely look like some sort of commitment by Israel to establish a pathway to a future Palestinian state. Not something that happens tomorrow or even the next day, but they do want, and some have used the term irreversible, that this is something that we're committed to establishing. It's going to help Israel in the long term security wise, that because you'll get Arab involvement and Arab security guarantees that will help re-stabilize Gaza after the war, and help Israel in that front. And also, I think, serve as a check as well to ensure that the Palestinian Authority is reformed. And if you don't do that, you're left, the U.S. officials have told me that Israel is just going to be left on its own to deal with Gaza, with no real significant help from its Arab partners, and Hamas will remain the most dominant player in Gaza, because you can't just try to defeat Hamas on the battlefield. You also need diplomatic efforts as well, and this is the only game in town. So that's the feeling of why this deal is necessary, and it's kind of the only way that the U.S. kind of sees. The U.S. was looking at this normalization deal before it's October 7th, but now it's kind of being used as a way to get out of the war, to end the war. And the talks, because of that, the talks have continued despite, I mean, it's quite remarkable, as you said, given the animosity towards Israel in the region, that the idea that Saudi Arabia could be negotiating in the midst of that animosity is quite remarkable. The gap, what I've understood when I was in Washington this week, was that there are some in the administration who think that Netanyahu would be willing to accept this Palestinian component of the normalization deal, and there are others who think he's just not going to be able to do that. One official explained the split as one between the White House and the State Department, while acknowledging that there are definitely exceptions to the rule. But basically, White House, the feeling is that there is a chance Netanyahu, when faced with a decision between one or the other, when recognizing that his legacy right now without any sort of deal will be defined solely by October 7th, that he will ultimately take the decision to accept this kind of deal and have to sideline his coalition partners, risk his political future possibly, but also with another option that other parties in the Knesset will come and support the legislation and maybe keep Netanyahu afloat a little bit longer. However, there are others in the State Department mainly who think that there's just no chance, that Netanyahu has done nothing to prove that he would be interested based off of his own rhetoric. It's not just a coalition matter. He ideologically does not believe in a Palestinian state, and he's not going to agree to one just because he's wanted a Saudi deal for so long, and that we might be just putting out a plan that just is kind of like a thought exercise. So there's this debate, and I think obviously it's too early to tell what Netanyahu will do, but it's interesting to see where the split is. I think it's notable that the White House is more optimistic, because I think those are the people that are ultimately going to be more decisive in this, and if they want to move forward, they're going to have the bigger say, as is typically the case in most administrations. The White House is kind of on top, but that's right now, that's the split that I'm hearing between the different branches.
We'll go to a short break.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, blankie. Their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic, because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. And Rebecca, while all of this is going on with the proposed Saudi normalization, the Palestinian Authority decided to move to have itself declared a state at the United Nations. And that vote, of course, did not go through because the United States vetoed it. Now, I don't know about you, but the veto itself was not a surprise to me. It was more surprising to me that the U.S. couldn't block the vote from taking place to begin with. Would you agree with that assessment?
They don't have so much leverage over the Palestinians anymore. I think there's a feeling in Ramallah that there were all these promises that the Biden administration made when it came into office, that it was going to reopen this consulate in Jerusalem, that it was going to reopen the Palestinian Liberation Organization's diplomatic office in Washington. It hasn't followed through in a lot of those things. And therefore, there's limited willingness in Ramallah to want to exceed these requests from the U.S. to shelve this vote. So the U.S. first tried to do that. I think they dangled another White House visit in front of Abu Mazen, but Abbas's office responded by saying, look, you guys have already told us we were getting a visit months ago and it hasn't happened. So why would we believe you now? So that didn't really work. And then after they understood that the vote was going to go forward, the U.S. tried to convince other countries on this 15-member council to either abstain or vote against. And because you need 9 countries in order to get this vote through. And if you get 9 or above, then you have to have one of the countries veto, one of the permanent Security Council members veto in order to block it. So the U.S. really didn't want to be isolated and be the only one blocking it. So they tried to convince their allies to vote with it on the council, and it royally failed. There was 12 votes that voted for this resolution, just 2 that abstained, which were Switzerland and the U.K. And the U.S. was left alone as the only country to raise its hand against the vote. And I think it was kind of a symbolic demonstration of the isolation on the international stage on this specific issue. And just looking at the numbers afterwards, we had France, Japan, South Korea, and Slovenia all voted yes. And I think France voted yes. And I think the last time the Palestinians tried to do this was in 2014 during the Obama administration. France did vote yes then. But the vote was more, I think they only got 8 votes in favor. So it didn't even need a U.S. veto at the time. This time, France votes yes again, but also Japan and South Korea and Slovenia, who all 4 of those countries don't individually recognize a Palestinian state. And one U.S. official I spoke with after the vote said, I think they were pretty bitter about the vote. And they were saying, look, these countries didn't even actually want this vote to actually be approved, but they knew that they would gain brownie points with the Palestinians and some circles of the international community if they voted against it. And they knew that they would be able to get those brownie points when the U.S. was going to veto anyway. So there were no actual consequences for their votes. So that was how the U.S. official I spoke with looked at it. The Palestinian Authority obviously fumed after the result, and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas on Saturday said that they might have to reevaluate U.S. ties. That's something he's threatened in the past over the past few years. He did follow through with it against Trump, and they did kind of cut ties during that period. But no official I've spoken with anything takes that threat seriously. The Palestinians still very much need the U.S. support, especially as they go through efforts to try to present a reformed presence. But that's the approach right now. I think there's anger both in Ramallah at the U.S. for vetoing and also in Washington that there is a feeling that we still have done a lot for the Palestinians, that we're the biggest donors to UNRWA still, even after we cut funding. There's nobody that comes close to us, at least in the coming year. And there's really no appreciation and no recognition that you were trying to do something that it's just on paper, that you did this in 2012 when you became non-member observer status at the UN, and Abbas went to New York and raised the flag of the Palestinian Authority or the Palestinian flag at the UN, and nothing obviously changed on the ground. And that would have been the result of this vote, even if it had gone through, that it's not going to have any tangible effects. And the US argues we're trying to actually advance a Palestinian state through this Saudi deal, and these kinds of efforts just get in the way of what we're trying to do, which would actually have results.
Is there any concern that the Palestinian Authority would turn to, for example, Russia or China and be their kind of vassal state, just as the way that the U.S. has been fostering relations with the Palestinian Authority until now or in the recent past?
So a few months ago, if you might remember, there was the meeting that Abu Mazen held in Russia with Vladimir Putin. And I think if he said some crazy things against the U.S. and in support of Russia at the time, it was not so far after the invasion. So definitely a sensitive issue. And there was deep, deep frustration in Washington. I think they put Abu Mazen in the doghouse for a few months because of that meeting. But at the end of the day, everyone understands that the U.S. is really the only game in town, and that the U.S., the Palestinians do try to flirt with the Chinese and the Russians to get more support. And they do. Those two countries have recognized Palestinians, recognized the Palestinian state already. But again, that's just proof that their recognition hasn't done anything. That the U.S. is what you really need in order to advance your cause. And that's why I don't think at the end of the day, the U.S., the Ramallah is going to totally abandon Washington.
Really fascinating. Bensi Gopstein, a far-right Israeli activist and close ally to National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, was targeted recently in a third round of sanctions imposed by the Biden administration that are aimed at clamping down on Jewish settler violence in the West Bank. So Gopstein is a pretty well-known figure here in Israel, but I wonder if our U.S. listeners know who he is. And I think if you tell us a little bit more about him, it'll paint a picture of what kind of person the U.S. is targeting.
Sure. So Gopstein is the head of the Lahava anti-miscegenation group. They're against Arab-Jewish relations, specifically marriages, but beyond that. And they're these kind of young thugs, often teens, who are sometimes seen, if you've ever been during tense times in Israel, running down through downtown Jerusalem, chanting death to Arabs, are often the other chants of that ilk. That's the Lahava group that he heads. He's also, that group also is known to protest the Pride Parade in Jerusalem every year. And Gopstein is often leading those protests of like a handful of people. And he's a very close ally to Itamar Ben-Gvir. He was convicted in January of incitement to racism. And he actually ran on, this was the same reason, incitement to racism, which led to his disqualification from the Knesset list by the Supreme Court. He tried to run on Ben-Gvir's Otzma Yehudit list several years ago and was disqualified, but he's still seen regularly at the Knesset in Otzma Yehudit meetings, at Ben-Gvir's National Security Ministry, and at his Knesset office. So he's definitely someone close to Ben-Gvir. And it's part of, I think, what I spoke with a U.S. official, they said that this is a part of a calculated decision to gradually target associates of government officials without sanctioning officials themselves, be it Ben-Gvir or Smotrich. I think they recognize that it's probably a step that's too far that they're not willing to take at this moment, but they do want these officials to be on notice, I think, through these sanctions. And they were coordinated with the EU, which on the same day on Friday as well announced that it was sanctioning Lahava, the organization itself, not just its leader. And this was also done alongside a sanction against Elisha Yared, who was a former spokesperson for Otzma Yehudit MK Limor Son Har Melech. So another person in Ben-Gvir's orbit. And there were also two other people that the EU sanctioned that have already been sanctioned by the U.S. So there's a lot of cooperation between the EU and the U.S. and other countries regarding this effort to try to sanction some of these extremist settlers. The U.S., other thing that I thought was noteworthy is that the U.S. in its third round also sanctioned two firms, the Mount Hebron Fund and the Shalom Asirayach organization, two very small far-right NGOs that had been fundraising for the sanctioned individuals, some of the settlers who have already been sanctioned in previous rounds. And the sanctions mention how those who are found to be donating to some of these individuals will also become targets of sanctions themselves. And I think this was a move, this was an escalation showing that those who violate our sanctions and or ignore them will become targets themselves. So I think there's a plan to be doing this every few weeks or months. But I know that this decision to roll out this third round was done, I think, against the backdrop, or at least moved up a little bit because of the latest spate of settler violence that we saw over the past week and spoke about in last week's podcast, where several Palestinians have been killed in either clashes with settlers, clashes with the IDF, but also under just unarmed civilians that were targeted and shot dead by Palestinians that have not, there hasn't really been any too many arrests made of settlers who have been involved in these in these rampages. And I think that's the point of these sanctions, to say that Israel on its own has clearly proven that it's not willing to take this issue seriously. So we need to act.
Okay, Jacob, thank you so much for your updates and insights today.
Thanks for having me, Amanda.
Pleasure. Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Please check out another installment tomorrow. This episode was produced by the Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until tomorrow, shalom.